Hello, my friends. Welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn, and this is episode 292 of the show. And today we're talking to Natalie Perkins. She has co-authored a book with our friend Hal Tausig. The name of the book is In Trembling Boldness, Wisdom for Today from Ancient Jesus People. This is like a devotional book. If you grew up in the same world I did, you did your morning devotions. Maybe you still do. That's fine. I still do a morning devotion type thing. But typically, back in the day, right, you'd have your Bible, maybe a devotional book that would be taking you through a book of the Bible like Matthew or Mark, Luke, John, whatever. And there would be like a daily thought for you to read along with whatever passage of scripture you read in order to kind of make that scripture come alive in like your modern day life. This book does the same thing, but with books like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, the Acts of Paul and Thecla. Think about a lot of those books found in the Nag Hammadi scriptures that we've talked about on the show before with Elaine Pagels, Bart Ehrman. Hal's been on the show before to talk to us about it. Those kinds of books and devotional material from those books. This book is so well done. I don't think there's anything close to something like this that's out on the market today, like in the bookstore, on Amazon, whatever. I mean, you can go and find a book like on the Gospel of Thomas, for instance, or on the Gospel of Mary, but I don't know of any book that takes a whole bunch of those books that didn't make it into the Bible and writes about them from a devotional perspective like this book does. It is so good. I was so excited to get this book in my hands. And I started to do like, I was like reading like one a day, and then I just read the whole thing because it was so good. And both Natalie and Hal did a fantastic job in this book. So anyway, Natalie's going to talk to us all about this book. She's going to talk to us about, the books that didn't make it into the Bible, some of the similarities in these books that are also in the books that we have in our Bible, as well as some of the differences. We cover a lot of ground, but this is a great episode. I've been sitting on it for a while. We recorded it like before Christmas, and life has just been a whirlwind at a backlog of episodes. Everybody in my house was sick. It was so many things have been going on, but we're getting it out now into the world. And I think what better time? It's just after Easter. All right, getting into the spring. Summer's going to be coming, and maybe it would be a good book for you to pick up and to make your way through over the course of the summer. So anyway, I'll put the links to Natalie's work in the show notes. Also in the show notes, friends, a brand new link, brand new segment of the What If Project website has hit the virtual world this week. It is called the Art Studio. Many of you know that I've been doing a lot of art. And if I could give you really quick the backstory, when I was a kid, I brought a sketch pad everywhere I went. Little known fact about me, I wanted to work for Disney when I was a kid. And then I wanted to go to art school. Because when I got into high school, in our art class, we did this segment on pop art, which is like, you know, really exaggerated colors. Surprise, surprise. I love color. Lots of colors, like really big shapes and stuff. And I just loved it. And I wanted to incorporate like cartoons with it and stuff. And I was just having a blast. And then there was somebody in my life who was very important to me, who was an actual real life artist. And this person told me that my art wasn't good enough to do the kinds of things I wanted to do. And it crushed my spirit. And so I said, all right, well, I put everything away. I put my sketchbooks away and packed everything up. And I took it out occasionally, like here and there over the years to make stuff. But I never really sat down with it to create anything, you know, that I had like any kind of goal to make or whatever. And so I put everything away. And then towards the end of 2023, I decided that 2024 was going to be a year to get reintroduced to my inner child. That inner younger part of ourselves that we often kind of send away when we get older because that person's immature, that person doesn't understand, that person just wants to have too much fun. We have to be adults, we have to be grown-ups, we have to do all these different things. And that person also can get in the way because sometimes that younger version of ourselves is what brings about a lot of the things that trigger us in life. Usually if we get really triggered by something, it's because there's a younger version of ourself that is responding to this thing that it's reminding him or her of from when you were younger. So anyway, I decided I want 2024 to be a year I'm going to get reintroduced to the younger version of myself. And so I wanted to really engage in some things that I enjoyed doing as a kid. And one of those things is art. And so for Christmas, Dana and Jordan got me a sketch pad. They got me some markers, some colored pencils. My mom got me some paints. And it was all very triggering for a little while. I really struggled for the first month or so to get the stuff out and to work with it. But then I started to do it more and more. And now I'm like, I can't stop making things. I'm just making so many different things. And I had Rob Bell on the show a while back, and he's doing a lot of his own art. And we were talking about art and stuff, and you know, he made a comment, was like, it's just creating stuff because it brings you joy. And if somebody likes it and somebody wants to get it, somebody wants to buy it or throw money at it, it's a bonus. But even if they don't, it doesn't matter because the joy is still there. And I feel like that's where I'm at with this stuff. Like, I've been painting, I've been drawing, I've been posting stuff, and people have been like, oh, that's really cool. And I've had some people say, I would love to buy that. Like, that sketch you made, would you put that on a canvas and paint it? And I will buy it from you. And that just blew my mind because, again, like, little Glenn was told that, like, your art is crap and it's not good enough. And here I am just making stuff for the fun of it. And I actually have people who are offering to buy it. And so anyway, I started this page on the website called The Art Studio. Because here's the thing. My hope is that, first of all, I need a place for all my, I want a place for my things I've been making to live, and I'll explain that more in a minute. But what I really wanted is to create a space that gives people the freedom to create stuff without the pressure of the likes and the shares, right? Because in our social media world, everything we create, we measure its success by how many times it's liked, how many times it's shared. And that's not really what it's about, right? Because what if you could create stuff with wild abandonment? Just create stuff. Whatever it is that you do. Do you do music? Do you do art? Do you do graphic design? What is it that you create? Do you write books, poetry? What if you could just create stuff with wild abandonment without giving two rips what anybody thinks about it? And the only reason that you're creating it is because it gives you joy, right? Like, when I sit down to paint something, I'm just doing it because it makes me happy. The colors, all the bright colors, the pop art aspect, a lot of the cartoons I'm able to put on there, it just makes me happy. It makes me smile. And so I make it and I create it. And what if you could do the same with whatever it is that you do? And so my hope is that this kind of an adventure that I'm on and this own lifeboat, again, that I'm in my own life, maybe it could create a safe space for you as well to do your own creating, whatever that might be, with wild abandonment, free from the likes and the shares and all the different things. So I created this space and I'm putting up some of my art because I want to have a place where my art can live. So I don't just share it on social media and it gets lost out there. But so I can actually have a place where I'm putting it, where people can see it and I can share it out. And also because there's a couple email forms on there because people have asked me to buy the stuff. I don't really care if people want it or not. I don't really care about making any money with it. But if you see something on there, there's an email form you can fill out. It's like a name your price thing. So as long as it covers the shipping, I'll give it to you. I don't care if it's, I don't know, if the shipping is $10, if you pay $10, fine, I don't care. I don't need to make any money off of it, but if you want it, it's there because I'm making stuff on canvases and I only have like so much room in the house for canvases. And so when I make something, there's some stuff I might want to keep. My mom likes some of my stuff too. So I've been giving her some of my things, a couple friends and stuff like that. But if you see something on there that pops up and you want it, I'm happy to give it to you. Just name your price, email me and we can figure it out. And then also, if there's something there that's sold, like there's one piece up there now that's sold, if you like that, I can make another one that's not going to be exact, but I can make one as you know, very similar to it. And then there's a second section that has like my idea book, because usually before I put something on a canvas, I have like a book of ideas. I'm just constantly making, you know, with paints and markers and all different things. So I'm taking some pictures of those, putting them up as well, because I've had some people, again, on Facebook reach out and say, oh, that's a really cool picture. Could you put that on a canvas for me and I'll buy it? And so that's just, again, mind-blowing to me. So I'm opening up my idea book. If you see something there that you like, again, name your price and I will make it for you and I'll send it to you. It's not going to be exact like it's, you know, is in the sketchbook, but the idea is there. And then also, if you see something, like if there's a cartoon, for instance, with some pop artish background, and you're like, oh, I love this idea, but I'm not a big Tom and Jerry fan, but I am a Flintstone fan. Can you make like Fred Flintstone on it instead? Just let me know, and I can kind of like, you know, customize it for you. So anyway, again, I'm just having a blast with this. Like, I'm having so much fun just making stuff. And a lot of the time, a lot of the things I've shared, you know, I've had people reach out to me and say, like, this stuff just makes me feel happy. Like, I'm looking at all these colors, I'm looking at these cartoon characters, I'm looking at this stuff, and it's doing something in my heart that's making me feel joyful. So thank you for doing this. And so, yeah, Art Studio. whatifproject.net/art is the page. Go check it out. And again, if you see something, let me know. Name your price. You can have it. And even if you don't see anything, just take a look through. And I hope that all of the colors and everything make you smile. Pretty cool. Like I said, I had Rob Bell on the show, and he does his thing. I think it's called the Rob Bell Art Show. And he's doing his own art, putting it up. And, you know, like he said to me, if people buy it, great. If they don't really care, because it's not about that. It's just about the joy that it brings him. I emailed him and I said I wanted to share with you what I've been making. And I, you know, gave him a little bit of background to it. And he wrote back, it's beautiful to see you turned loose in the world and with all this color. Cheering you on, Rob Bell. So pretty cool. I'll put the links in the show notes to the art site. Again, all Natalie's links as well. Links to my books, Rethinking Everything, Emerging from the Rubble. And also Patreon if you want to support the show financially. That is a place that you can do just that. So anyway, all that to say, my friends, episode 292 with Natalie Perkins. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today we are sitting down with a brand new guest who has co-authored an incredibly interesting book. Her name is Natalie Perkins. The name of the book is In Trembling Boldness, Wisdom for Today from Ancient Jesus People. And so Natalie, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have this time with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Definitely. So before we get into the book, can you take a few minutes to maybe tell us about yourself, especially for people who aren't familiar with you and your work? I know you're a pastor. So who are you? What are some things you do? Tell us what we need to know.
I'm a multi-hyphenate. I am a minister at Middle Church in New York City. I mm-hmm. serve as the minister for digital strategy and engagement. Mm-hmm. I'm also a writer. You know, I have this book here. Yeah. And I'm a professional performer, musical theater mostly. But I have been doing a lot of singing with symphonies. I'm on my way to Indianapolis tomorrow, actually, to sing with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra for their holiday season. They do a show there called Yuletide that I participate in every year. So
that's awesome. Yeah, is that online anywhere? Is that going to be online anywhere, or is it just in
that's
person?
That's just in Indianapolis. Yeah.
Gotcha.
I have an album that's online. You know, anywhere, I guess you can find music sold. It's called Songs of Your Truth.
Okay. So, yeah. I'll put that link in the show notes. But how did you get involved? Like, if you've been doing music, I'm assuming you've been doing music for a long mm-hmm. time. How did mm-hmm. you get involved in church ministry? Was there like an overlap for you, or like what brought mm-hmm. you to ministry in particular? Probably a long story, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know. Like, I feel like I don't know a time when the two were separated. But I was actively not trying to do ministry. I was like, I don't want to do that. That's not for me. Like,
right.
God, you called the wrong person. Sort of energy for a long
get
time.
Somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when that didn't work, I was like, okay, well, let me make a bargain with you. Like, here's the ways in which I can do that and still live like the life that I'm doing and want to live. And, you know, also didn't work.
So, God said, all right, we'll see. We'll see how that works for you.
Yeah, cool, cool, cool. Like, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
So it was another minister who kind of had been observing me that said, have you received a call to ministry? And I burst into tears. and had to do a little bit of reconciling with myself that really what I was pushing back around was my own sense of worthiness. You know, it wasn't whether I wanted to or not, honestly, it was that I didn't feel like I was good enough or that I deserved to be the person who would be called to work like this, or that like I had the right moral compass or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is just attached to what we have been told churches and Christianity is and God is versus what it actually is, what it actually means to follow the way of Jesus, to have a relationship with God. All of that is different to me now than it was when I grew up, right?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so when I was able to accept that okay, this is a call and I'm being called not in spite of, but because of, you know, who I am. Then I was able to really dig into, okay, so what do you believe and what do you really think about this? And seminary is a great place to do that sort of thing, right? Like
it is, you sort out a lot of things there.
Yeah, you sure do. You sure do. You're learning, you know, a lot of just very concrete facts around stuff. And that just helps you understand like, okay, so then what do I believe as a result of that? What still stands, what doesn't. And, you know, they call a cemetery because it's where your faith goes to die.
Yeah.
so it really just, I think, you know, even when they say that, I really think it depends on the person and what it is that your faith is rooted in, right? Like, if it's rooted in having to be right or wrong, then yeah, I could see how it might be death dealing.
Yeah.
But if it's rooted in something bigger than you, something that life giving, loving, then the facts mean something different in relationship to your faith.
That's right. Yeah, I've seen a lot of people go to seminary and like you said, their faith does collapse. It does fall apart. But other people, like for me, I felt like in many aspects it did, but I felt like there was something there that was like, I want to put this back together to make something new, you know, it's just going to
evolve.
That's
what I always
it's
say.
Still look different, but it's going to be, it's still going to be there. It's going to look different.
Yep. That's what I always say is that they dismantle it and they should, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's take this whole thing apart. What do you actually think? And then it's up to you whether you rebuild it or not.
Correct. Yeah.
That's not the job of the seminary to rebuild your faith. That's on you.
Yeah. They give you the tools. And then you have to go from there, right? Mm-hmm. So tell me about this position, because I really quick, I'm interested about digital strategy and engagement, because that's not like a position you hear about at a lot of churches, but it grabbed my attention because when I went to seminary, I went back to get my DMin degree and I did my dissertation on how the church can use social media and technology to connect with people. And so that's kind of where this podcast was kind of birthed from my final paper and stuff. So I'm interested to hear a little bit about that and kind of how that came to be.
Yeah, I think I have not been corrected on this. I think that it's right and true that I'm only the second person in the UCC denomination. When I got ordained, I was only the second person in the denomination to be ordained into digital ministry. There was one other person before me and she was not ordained. It's interesting. She's a Black woman as well. She was not ordained solely into digital ministry because at the time they just people didn't take it seriously. So it was like digital ministry and I don't know, Christian education, let's say, you know, like you can't just have this one call. We're going to have to like bind this with something else to find it to be a worthy call. And the UCC denomination, a call really is ultimately a job. Like, do you have a job mm-hmm. that you're called to? And then yes, you can be ordained to do that work. Mm-hmm. And you can go from there after you're ordained. But, and so I think, and I got ordained, I'd been trying to get ordained for about 5 years. I got ordained in December of 2020. Mm-hmm. So pretty quickly after the pandemic, they were like, oh, we need to get her down the road because
this is a real thing.
We actually need to know these things now. That's my assessment of it. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of stuff. But like, yeah. And I'm the first I know, or think anyway, think I know, in the Metro NYC area to be ordained into digital ministry.
Yeah.
And I had been interested in it because I did a lot of traveling as a performer and trying to find churches and where do you go and how do you, you know, do church when you, you know, live on a bus, essentially. You know, I lived on a coach bus for like a year and a half of my life. And outside of even that, I was on the tour of Hairspray and Rent. And then outside of that, just regional theaters, just trying to find, you know, basic things like where do you go to eat? Who can do black hair and where can I go to church, you know? And so I kept trying to figure out where to go to church and I stumbled across Life Church, which is not a black church, but what I learned was there were Life Churches all over the country and they do this sort of like Kaplan-esque model where every month, I don't know when they send it, but I imagine it's every month they send each of their church plants the materials for the month, right? Here's like the four sermons that you're going to be preaching. Here's, you know, the script and where you can put examples in from your own life or, you know, that sort of thing. Here's the bulletin design. You just have to like go and print it. So it's very paint by numbers. And I felt like I could be in one city one week and get like the first sermon of the series there, be in a whole different city the next week and get the second sermon of the series there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I felt like I got to grow spiritually because I stayed connected to a progression. I learned songs that I didn't grow up with, but because I heard them regularly as I was moving throughout the country, that became mine, you know?
Yeah.
They all had the same sorts of groups. They all had the same sorts of slides. It's very like I said, paid by numbers.
Yeah.
And it made me think that there's gotta be other people besides me who are out on the road and gone from home for work and can't get to their home churches on Sunday. And what if there's some way for them to do that? And that's what really piqued my interest about like, what do we do at home? Like, what does your local church do? The church that I was at when I first started seminary was not really in that space. I mean, no one was, that they weren't really thinking about digital ministry. What are we doing in that world? Right.
Yeah.
But the second church that I interned at, which ended up being Middle, there was someone there who was thinking about this. And so I finally had like a thought partner around that. And then there was some teasings of this sort of work at the seminary as well. I could take like a 2-day course or something like an SU course, to talk about like some aspects of, you know, like here's how you can use YouTube or here's, you know what I mean? Like those sorts of things.
Yeah. Right.
That weren't like an all-encompassing, we were really building from scratch our own thing. There wasn't something already created. So it wasn't like I could go take a class and learn how to do it. I just was doing it on my own.
Yeah.
So I used the seminary to get the information and knowledge on what I really needed and didn't know and knew they had. And then I used my thought partner and my own exploration to build a thing that didn't exist.
Yeah. I love that because we could probably do a part two of this conversation and just talk about that because it's hard to find somebody who is in that line of thinking. And I real quick, I'll just say that when I started my dissertation, a lot of people, this was before the pandemic, were like, it's digital ministry is like, you know, it's like not real ministry kind of thing, you know, because you have to be in person, in the flesh. You're not going to have real relationships. Like that's not real ministry, you know? And then all of a sudden when the pandemic happened, after I did my dissertation, I remember I posted, I was like, does anybody want my dissertation? Cause I have a how-to guide. I have some different ideas for you, you know, because obviously this is a real thing.
Now it's real.
Exactly.
And the pandemic was an awful thing that happened to this world, you know, like on a global scale, it was just really colossally traumatizing. It's just wild to me, like how we all survive this really devastating moment together and all have this shared lived experience as a nation, as a, not a nation, as a globe.
The world, yeah.
And I, in the same thoughts also, I'm like, I don't know that the church, some churches were, but the church, capital C church, would have ever really taken digital ministry seriously except that moment happened.
You're 100% right.
We were forced to, you know?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's so many things. Like you said, it was an awful time, but there's a lot of things I think that people are awakened to in the power of the virtual world, whether it's in church, even in businesses. A lot of businesses do a lot of virtual work now as well. So anyway, I think we'll continue. We can continue that, I think, on another time, because I already have a lot of questions for you. But we'll segue back into your book, In Trembling Boldness. Can you maybe begin, before I spill my questions all over the place, can you tell us about this book? Because it is a very unique book. Like I said before, hit record, there's not much out there that addresses this material in the way that you do. So can you tell us what this book is about? And most importantly, who is like your target audience? Who's the reader that you're going for?
In Trembling Boldness, Wisdom for Today from Ancient Jesus People is a introduction to some ancient texts, just a few of them. I think there's eight in there. And also a collection of devotionals or reflections or meditations, whatever you want to call them, that use this extra-canonical text as scripture. Kind of like you would see in a, you know, a traditional devotional. Some of them are telling stories of how people came across these texts. And we tried to, for the majority of those stories, center the experiences and lives of marginalized people. So people you generally don't see in a devotional, trans people, people of color, elderly people, like there's just like, how do we tell those sorts of stories? And some of them are real stories from people that we, you know, my co-author is also a minister and was the professor that got me interested in these texts, Reverend Dr. Hal Taussig. We were really interested in making sure that we shared these stories. Some of them are from us doing ministry in the world, and some of them are stories we made up, and some of them are our own stories, to try and get a variation and make sure that a lot of people who generally go unseen find themselves, right? And in that same vein, we know that the universal is in the particular, but the universal has always skewed white, it's always skewed male, it's always skewed Christian. So our goal was to still be able to make these very particular, like show this example that here's the particular and you've all found yourself there.
Yeah.
So what if you read marginalized stories and found you in it? Right? That does some real community building work.
Yeah. That's so
as
good.
As a result.
I love that. How did you like, how did you, obviously the Hal introduced you to the material, and he's been on the show before a couple of times. And we talked about his New Testament, and he was on with a couple other guests. I forget their names off the top of my head, but they all wrote a book together. They were on the show
is
together.
It the Before Christ.
Yes, I can't think of the title, but I have all the words in my head, but I can't think of the exact title.
After Jesus, Before Christianity.
Yes, that's the one. But they were on, they were talking about some of this material. But did you have any like association with these texts before you connected with Hal, or was he the introduction to them? And then like, if whenever that happened, like, was there any trepidation on your end when you got involved with these texts? Because we talked again before we hit record about how for myself and a lot of our listeners, we've been told these are so evil, they're so bad, they're going to drag you away from the true word kind of thing. Like, did any of that, did you wrestle with any of those things or not really?
I had not heard of any of these texts before I got to seminary. I don't, in my best recollection, maybe I did and didn't think anything of them because of that same reason, like you don't look at those. But I didn't, I grew up CME, so there's other texts that we weren't engaged in either, you know, like there's a whole Apocrypha in some people's Bibles that I'm like, what do you do with that? Right. You know, I don't know what that is either. Right. So I don't think I ever had any real trepidation around them. I do think the environment helped that I met them in seminary, mm-hmm. not day one, you know, yep. like it was probably the second semester. Was it second semester or was it towards the end of second semester or so that I got introduced to these texts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious. And there was someone who could talk to me about them who actually knew some stuff about, you know.
Yeah.
For a lot of these scholars who work with that, it's they also know the context in the region. Like that's really the point and goal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not like trying to. And I feel like this is like that with any of these scholars, like not trying to do some like faith work of interpretation, but here's what the text says and here's what that meant in that time, because we yep. know this, and this.
Yep.
And you can do that all the way down the line with all of our traditional texts. Like, mm-hmm. so this is just doing that work. Me as a minister, then I'm wondering like, so then what? So now what? So why does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
As we live our lives, and if these other texts matter for how we live our lives, then I think these probably do too.
Mm.
And reading them, informs what you thought you knew and gives you a wider understanding of the divine, because you have a wider understanding of the time period in which people were thinking this and what they were thinking, what was happening with them.
Mm.
You know, so it's, to me, it's just a, I don't see the downside in it, right? Like the sure. only thing it can do is make your relationship with God more expansive.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was in seminary, I always say that I'm jealous isn't the word, but I feel like I missed out because like the school I went to, we did a lot of history and stuff like that and culture in regards to the biblical text. But when it came to these mm-hmm. texts, I was told by a lot of professors, like, there's just nothing in there for you to know. And we're just not going to talk about some kind of thing. And I was really told, like, you know, those things will lead you in other directions. I was like, okay. And I was like the good Christian soldier, like, all right, I'm just not going to mm-hmm. touch it. No, I'm going to just do my thing and keep doing my work. And when I started the podcast and I started rethinking my faith, everything like that, you know, I started to dig into some of these things. I read, I think it was Elaine Pagels. It might've been Hal. Mm-hmm. I don't remember who it was, but somebody said to me, on the podcast, like these texts matter to somebody. Like these texts inform somebody's faith. You know, for whatever reason, church fathers were saying they should be destroyed, get rid of them. Somebody put them away for some reason, whether because they meant that something part. To them, they wanted future generations to have them, they wanted to defy the whatever it is, whatever the reason is, they mattered to somebody. And shouldn't they then matter to us in some way? And that was like really interesting to me because I never. That put like a lot of humanity on these texts, whereas in school mm-hmm. it was all about, you know, specific pieces of theology that, you know, aren't the right way to think. But when you take that away and you realize that these texts matter to somebody, they inform somebody's faith. And then I came across Bart Ehrman's book, Lost Christianities, and the plural mm-hmm. Christianities. So it's mm-hmm. like a many Christianities. I was like, what is this about? And mm-hmm. I started to really read about that and really began to realize like the Orthodox faith that I was handed was just one narrow stream of many streams of thinking. And a lot of these other texts fell into those other streams of thinking, whether it's the Valentinians or it's the, you know, whatever branch of Gnostics there were, whatever. But mm-hmm, these were people mm-hmm. who considered themselves Christians. They just mm-hmm. thought differently than that narrow Orthodox way. And I think that, again, like it just helped me realize like, oh, I can be a Christian even if I don't fall in this very narrow lane anymore. There's other places for me to land. And I can even adopt different things and I can think my own way, but yet still be in that lane of Christianity, which really meant a lot for me just in my own faith journey. So,
yeah, I do think that I'm very lucky or divinely aligned, I guess depends on what you
whatever term you want to use.
Yeah. That I ended up at Union,
mm.
A space that is very open, Union Theological in New York City, very open to letting you sort out, working out your own salvation. You know, with fear and trembling boldness, is important there. So however you discern this thing, like you yeah. got to do it because you got to own it versus like, let me tell you what you should think about this. And then good luck carrying that through your whole life if it's rooted in somebody else, right? And
sure.
what somebody else told you, what somebody else thinks.
Yeah.
So that whole deconstruction that a lot of people are experiencing are because they've been carrying someone else's theology versus having a space to build their own, right? Like as a kid, what if you gave children space to ask these what if questions and then answer them as honestly and authentically as you can so that they can rightly discern how they hold and what measures up for them around their budding moral compass.
That's right. You know? You're preaching now. That'll
preach.
That's right. So how did you come to decide what books you were going to write about? Because for our listeners, I'm just going to read off a list of some of them that are in here, but you talk about Gospel of Thomas, The Thunder Perfect Mind, The Acts of Paul and Thecla, Gospel of Mary is in here, Gospel of Truth, The Thought of Noria, Odes of Solomon, and Prayer of Thanksgiving. Like there's a couple in here that I wasn't even aware of, but there's also a lot obviously that are not in here because there's literally hundreds of them. So I'm curious, like, how did you and Hal decide which ones were going to be included? Were there any that were kind of on the cusp of making it in, but didn't make the cut? Like, what was that process like for you guys?
I imagine there were. Now I'm like, what were they? I think what happened first is we wrote a bunch of devotionals.
Mm.
And then in the narrowing down process, you know, that's, we ended up with the text we got. I work primarily with Thunder Perfect Mind, The Acts of Paul and Thecla, The Odes of Solomon, and a little bit of Gospel of Thomas. Like those are my worlds.
Yep.
I think if I were to go do a PhD on any of that, I'd have to narrow even further because there's enough, right? Those texts by themselves are enough rather than like, let me just try and know the whole of the thing, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe I could, I don't know. Anyway. And then Hal, you know, is a scholar of all of first and second century and all of these texts. Honestly, I think he probably goes all the way up to fourth. I'm not sure. Let me not speak for his
knowledge. He knows a lot of
knowledge.
Things. Put it that way.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's where some of these other texts came in, like the Prayer of Thanksgiving. I've also spent some time on, but it's not like my scholarly work. The Thought of Noria, same situation, you know, Gospel of Mary. So some of these, like, I've had a fair amount of interaction with, but as far as like me giving you some real contextual grounding for them, like he is the one that kind of holds that more.
Yep.
So I think that we ended up narrowing down because of the text that we just like to read and look at and have found life-giving for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then like what devotionals have we already written and can we, you know, put in a collection itself, right? Like you'll notice the Odes of Solomon has a lot of devotionals, whereas I think the Prayer of Thanksgiving probably has a whole, you know, probably two or three there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the Odes of Solomon is a collection of worship material, right? Mm-hmm. So it's written kind of, or it lends itself easily to something like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Prayer of Thanksgiving is one page. It's a one page prayer, you know? So what are you able to like really, you know, I always say, if is the juice worth the squeeze?
Sure.
What are you really able to, what juice can you get from that versus like, you know, 41 odes?
Yeah, that's so good. All right, so I want to ask you about kind of like a two-sided question. Number one is about some of the similarities between these texts and what we might find in the traditional scriptures, then also the differences. So first, some of the similarities, because again, like a lot of things I was told, people who are listening were told, is the stuff in here is vastly different than everything that you're going to find in the Bible. It's almost like it's a different religion kind of thing. But I know on my own journey through some of this material, and it's very young in this journey, but some of the things I've read, there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of similarities, especially like in the Gospel of Thomas. There's a lot of differences, but there's also things where I'll read, I'm like, oh, I remember Jesus saying this in Luke or Jesus saying this in Matthew. So what are some of like the similarities that you've come across in your own studying of this stuff between these texts and some of the biblical texts?
I mean, they were, so a lot of them were written around the same time, right?
That's another thing I was told that's not true, is that they were written so far after.
That's not true. Yeah, first and second century are the ones that I spend my time with. And also they then had access to each other, right? So, Gossip Thomas, being a great example here, is literally just a list of sayings and deeds. Like, Jesus said this, Jesus said this, he said this, he said this, he did this, he
Like
did this, he
rapid
said this, he did this, he said this, he said
fire,
this. That's all, yeah. And so then the other, so then when you read the other gospels, you notice when they start to midrash, right? Let's put a little story in here, let's put some meat on the bones here, let's get, you know. And I don't know, we don't know. Really, we don't know like who had access to what first and how, you know, like we can guesstimate and based off of what we research and whatnot. But I'm curious, like then like are you holding Gospel of Thomas, you know, or have you read it? And then like as you are also telling this story, you know, 50 years, 85 years, whatever, after the death of Jesus, if someone asked me to remember something from 20 years ago, I might remember like something specific being said to me. I might remember some specific thing that happened, but the context of the stuff around that, what happened that, what did I have for breakfast that morning? Where had I just come from? Where was I going later? Might be a little fuzzy, you know? So all of these were in conversation with each other and trying to consider the audience that they were trying to speak to, right? Like, how do I say this in the way that this audience is really going to hold this with me? And then it like, so for me, that means like Mark, right, is the first, he's the oldest in the first gospel. So then the other ones are like, okay, let's like take this one and add a little juice in there. Like, here's what, this is how this would work for me, the author of Luke. This is how this would work for me, the author of Matthew. John is like doing his own thing. So yeah, I think in that way, it's important that we recognize that all of these came together around the same time as each other and were important, like texts that were being read regularly up until what I think the 15th century, if I'm remembering correctly, is when, you know, we essentially our canon comes together a little more haphazardly than we like to admit, you know, where we like found a letter that a bishop wrote that was an Easter letter that was like, here are the texts that you should be reading, you know, but not really knowing that this is what they did every single year, is sent this letter that was like, here's the text that you should be reading. And it stuck, and that's the ones that we got, you know. Yeah, I think that letter is written in 15, and then we found the letter, what, 16 or
I think
something,
it
or
was like
maybe,
mid 16 or I don't
yeah, and
yeah
that
something.
was
It was late. It
also
was later than I
exactly
was
when,
ever told. Right.
yeah, and that's also when the printing press came about. And so then they were like, then it was solidified because it went, it was mass produced, you know, versus before people could read it, but it was fine because somebody else is reading this. And the next year, you're going to get some different text to read because this is like, let's talk about this framing this year, you know, kind of like how churches do themes now, but we kind of let that go when we like solidified the canon.
Yeah, when I read like the when I came across Gospel of Thomas and learned about, you know, some people say that's the Q document, some people say there's a different Q document, whatever. But there's some kind of list of sayings. When I started really reading Thomas and thinking about the Gospels, I felt like it made so much more sense as to why the stories were different, because it's not like, you know, they were recording necessarily like step like the Jesus cam following him around, you know, giving historical events, but they were forming these stories around these sayings to fit the particular thing that their audience was going through. And then I feel like that for me, like I'm a very creative thinker, so I feel like that for me freed up a whole lot of my mind to like imagine, like I wonder why Mark told the story this way, knowing that these people are living in the wake of like Nero's wrath kind of thing, or, you know, people of Matthew living in the wake of the temple falling. I wonder why Matthew, the writer of Matthew, wrote the story like this, and how that would have really fit with what these people were going through. And I feel like when you think about that and you let your mind kind of go, you know, I feel like it again, like the Gospel of Thomas really informed the way that I read the Gospels. All right, so what about the differences then? Let's talk about some of those, because, like, for instance, you said the Gospel of Mary is one of your wheelhouses that you were in. There's some things in the
Oh,
Gospel of
not really,
Mary.
not that one.
Oh,
No. Minor, Thunder Perfect Mind, Acts of Paul and Thecla,
that's right,
Odes
Acts
of
of Paul and Thecla.
Solomon,
Yeah.
and a little bit of Thomas.
Yeah, okay.
But
So in
I really love the Gospel of Mary, but yeah, that one's.
me too. That one has blown my mind a little bit. And there's some things in there that there's just a lot in there. But what are some things that you've come across, whether it's in there or these other texts that are different than what you have found in the traditional gospels that maybe are far off, or maybe it's something that's made you think differently about something that is in the text? Like what are some of those examples?
I think it's interesting, like we tend to think that these texts are so very different from what we have. And in a lot of ways they just aren't. They are really similar. You know, like what I was getting ready to say was like, oh, well, some of them aren't like Christocentric, like they don't say Christ, but we have texts in our New Testament that don't say Christ, you know, so and we've decided that still means that they fit, you know, because that's the book, that's where they are. They live in our book, right? In our canon, and that's been ordained.
It's closed.
Yeah, so I'm like, what makes them different? I think, nope. I was gonna say like some of the fantastical storying, but then we have Revelation, so
Right. But then there's that book. It's a little bit fantastical in itself.
what's different? You know, the prayer of Thanksgiving is really just a prayer. That's the whole text. And I don't know that we have another text in our traditional canon that's like that. It's short. We also don't have one that's that short. And then there are women who are clearly at the center of the narrative. That feels different. And even like titled as such, right? Like the Gospel of Mary, we don't have anything in our traditional canon that is the Gospel of insert woman name here, right? And there are three texts that come to mind immediately, right? Like the Acts of Paul and Thecla being one, the Gospel of Mary, and then Thunder Perfect Mind is the story of this deity that mostly identifies as female, sometimes identifies as male. And so it might be okay to say trans, you know, in that way. We don't, you know, we don't know, but we do know that it's not a mistake of tr of it's not a typo. We used to think it was a typo, and so we were mistakenly translating it differently. There's one passage where Thunder says, "I am he, the mother," and it's like, oh no, they clearly meant she, the mother, right? Let me just like fix that and when I do my little English translation. But no, that's like what they meant, right? And so having to recognize that a lot of the stuff that we want to act like are anomalies and didn't exist, and all of that then, and do now, well, clearly that must be, you know, outside of what it's supposed to be, but that's not the case. They were there then, you know, and maybe it wasn't an anomaly. Maybe this is just like what the world is. And so it teaches us different holding for what we are experiencing today, and how we have crafted a world that shuts people out, you know, because of what we think it says and what we thought it was. And so introduction to texts like that, teach us an ancient history, teach us an ancestral holding of communal belonging, you know?
Yeah. Think one of the ones for me that has came across as very different at first, but then once I started to see it, now I see things in the biblical text that are in this other book, but the Gospel of Truth. And that's not, I feel like that's a It's a little bit of a deeper book in a lot of different ways, but then there's a
It's
lot.
a
There's,
beautiful book, though.
yeah, 90% of it I don't understand. I'm open about that. But there's this one part where it talks about, and I'm going to get it wrong, but it talks about how the main problem that we have as humans, rather than being sinful or whatever, is that we forget. Like forgetfulness is our biggest problem. And that just awakened like so much in me because I'm like, isn't that like the truth? Like we, if you know, the Bible says that we're, you know, God breathed into Adam. So the breath of God is in all of us. We're made in the image of God. I mean, it says that in our Bible, but how often do we just forget that? And we pick up our baggage from the world. We live like this, we live like that, we do this, we do that. And that image gets so easily covered up, but it's still there. And for me, that's been helpful for my daughter because my daughter's in first grade. And so she knows I do the podcast. She says, you have all these Jesus books all over the place. And so we talk a lot about like Jesus, and she asks about, you know, like the cross and what's that about. And I've been talking to her about like sometimes we just forget who we are. Like we're all made in the image of God. We're made to be in this way, you know, these loving people, these kind people, but we forget that. Don't you forget that sometimes? She's like, yeah, I forget that all the time. Like, yeah, me too. But when I look at Jesus and I look at when he was put on the cross and the way he responded and, you know, his love and his forgiveness he poured out, I said, it reminds me of who I really am. And I said, so in that way, it's like a salvation moment every single day, you know, when I forget who I am. And it's just that for me, like that brought a whole new life to the gospel. But now when I read a lot of these gospel stories, I see that in there. You know, it's been there the whole time. I just never really saw it before.
I love that framing that about how we forget, you know?
Yeah. I feel like
It's
it
always there.
brings a whole different angle to it. So, last question for
Lest I
you.
forget.
Well, I'm sorry.
I was just thinking that song, Lest I Forget. Gethsemane.
Yep, definitely. So how does this stuff work its way into your everyday life? Like, do you read this stuff on a regular basis? Like, are you're a pastor, so does it make your way into any kind of teachings? Do you reference it, you know, kind of off the cuff if you're doing a teaching, like, oh, it says in the Acts of Paul and Thecla, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or does it, do you, I'm curious about how it makes its way into your personal life and then how it makes its way into your ministry, you know, as well.
Yeah, so I fully preach these texts. I preach from it was so funny. I just preached this past Sunday and someone was like, "Oh my gosh, you're preaching like from the lectionary, you're preaching from the Bible." I was like, "I know, twice in 1 year." Like that's
What a
how
heretic.
rarely I preach from the I generally would preach the extra canonical texts because they are so aligned, right? It's an easy win in that way. And then you're also teaching people this expansiveness of their faith, of their understanding of the divine, of the time period in the community, you know. So in that way, I interact with them a lot. And then I wrote an album that was just that ended up being a project that for school when I was in seminary from Hal's class. He had a class called Opening Canon. And there were like two big projects. One of them was a paper and the other one didn't have to be whatever we wanted it to be. And so I wrote songs using these texts. And so in that way they always live in me. Whether I read them just because, you know, I like the stories, or whether I'm writing something, or, you know, I don't know. A New Testament and what is one of the more beat up books on my bookshelf as a result. Because it's just juicy, you know. There's just a lot in there. And you, similar to the Bible, you can't read them enough and think that you've got it. You've solved it, mischief managed. Every single time I read it, there's something else there that makes me think, consider something maybe in a different way. And I think that's so valuable, right? Like, what a gift that is to be able to do that. And then oftentimes also, I'm able to connect it with something else that I've read in our traditional New Testament text, and helps me connect what's happening over there, right? Like, oh, okay, so there aren't any women in who are named, but they were certainly like women who were in charge.
Yeah.
And the Bible is trying to say that in some ways, in the subversive ways it's trying to say it.
Yeah.
You know, based on like what we know about that time period and what would have been allowed, you know?
Yeah. What I love about what you just said is that like you're bringing this into, I was curious if you brought it into church, and obviously you do since you preach from these texts, but I think it's so good to that you're normalizing this stuff for people, because I know there are a lot of people I've heard different things about these things, but I think when they see somebody like yourself who is educated and who is standing in a pulpit and is able to bring these ideas down to them, it's almost like you're touching these taboo topics, but you're bringing them out into the light to show there's really nothing to be afraid of, because like you said, there are so many overlaps, there are so many similarities. We can read something here in the Acts of Paul and Thecla, which can really inform what we're reading over here in some of our traditional texts. And I think that when people see that, it really helps normalize things. I think that your book and Hal's obviously New Testament have really done that for people. So props to you.
Thanks. Yeah, we had a great time writing it. I'm so grateful that I got to work with one of my mentors, like, you know, that he was willing to, you know, help me do this thing. He's always trying to see how we can help people get their foot in the door around publishing. So I'm just, you know, grateful to have a mentor like him.
So good. Well, we're just about out of time, but this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for taking time for me and for our listeners, and thanks for the work you do.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Yeah, for sure. And real quick, where can people go to find you online? Any place to go in particular to connect with you? Or
I'm Diva Does Divinity on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Well, formerly known as Twitter.
Whatever it is.
Now X.
Elon Musk.
And also on Threads. But yeah, I go to middlechurch.org. That's where I am. I serve as a digital minister there. And that's where, like, if you're wanting to try and have some sort of conversation, that would be the best place to start versus showing up in my DMs.
Awesome.
I didn't have time for all that.
Right. Who does, right? I don't even go in there sometimes.
Like, don't do it.
That's
just
right.
Email me at the church.
Awesome. I'll put the links in the show notes, and we'll do this again sometime, maybe.
All right. Thank you so much.